You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.
You want to run that by me again, the reading part?
Dude, I don't read. Now you're making me read like again and again. You and I cannot do an interview in which I'm not hostile at you.
Oh, good.
Are we still doing levels?
Hostile interviews are always the best, you know.
Are we still doing levels?
Am
I reading for levels?
No, we're rolling.
So this is real.
Yeah.
I'm reading for real?
For real. For reals.
Now I'm uncomfortable. This is Being the Chronicles of Abby Normal, Completely Fucked Servant of the Vampire Flood. I have failed, left my duty undone, like so much dog poop on the gloaming sidewalk of the tragedy that is my life. Even as I sit here at the Metreon Starbucks writing this, the frost slaves seem to move like silver-eyed zombies, and my non-fat soy amaretto mochaccino has gone as bitter as snake bile, which is like the bitterest bile you can get. If there wasn't a totally hot guy two tables away acting like he doesn't notice me, I would weep. But real tears make your mascara run, so I am staying chilly in my despair. Your loss, cute guy, for I have been chosen. Suffer, bitch. Did you want me to keep reading?
Let
me make this clear. I don't read. I'm now finished.
Okay, good.
Well, now let's do an interview.
All right, good. Close the book. There we go. Mm-hmm. Christopher Moore is the winner of the Quill Award and author of the best-selling novels that include A Dirty Job and his latest, the sequel to 1995's Bloodsucking Fiends, You Suck. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Thank you.
Chris, let's talk a little bit about your supernatural San Francisco setting.
Okay.
You've been working on this for a while, haven't you?
I've been working in it for a while, I think, on and off over about the last 12 years, I guess. I wrote my first San Francisco set book in 95 and then returned again for A Dirty Job in 2004, and then this one has just come out.
Why did you choose San Francisco initially?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, I was living on the central coast of California, and it was close. And second, I just thought it would be a great city to have a vampire story in. I wanted an urban setting because my other books had been sort of set in smaller towns. And San Francisco has a great contrast of light and dark as a city.
Tell us a little bit about it. It has a lot of contrast, and you play upon that a lot in your books, you know, the grit and the beauty, the wealth and the poverty. Tell us how you work that contrast to get some humor.
Well, I think that the city sort of has exactly it's an extraordinarily wealthy city at one end, but it's got a huge population of homeless people. So you have these two populations interacting in my books because they tend to, you know, or try to ignore each other. And then you have this sort of aesthetic beauty because it's a very pretty city, but you also have these sort of dark neighborhoods and neighborhoods that really change when it gets dark. They go from being sort of very pretty and quaint to being just a little bit scary. And that's a perfect contrast for a horror novel, or a humor horror novel anyway. It's a small town in its own way, too. And so you have, you know, all comedy comes out of the interaction of disparate elements. And so you have disparate elements coming in contact in this little sort of compact city on the peninsula.
Your first novel in the vampire horror humor vein was Bloodsucking Fiends. And I want to ask, what made you want to write a romantic comedy with fangs?
Actually, it wasn't my first choice. I had to submit three ideas to my publisher at the time because I had a book due on a contract, and then they would pick one. And I wanted to do a book about a blues singer from Clarksdale, Mississippi, who goes to Chicago to find his fortune, but in his 80s, not in his 30s, like Muddy Waters and B.B. King. And they picked this idea that was like a thrown off two line thing. Oh, there's this guy who has a girlfriend and she's a vampire and he puts her in the freezer. And it was from a piece I'd done on radio like, I don't know, 10 years before that, I think. I used to do a radio show called Nightshades Cafe where I would do little stories that I wrote and then play music in between. I sort of had, you know, arrows pointing to it going, oh, you wouldn't want this one. But they called and said, oh, we want you to do the vampire book. And I was a little bit chagrined. But so it wasn't initially my decision. But once I did it, it was a lot of fun. So I sort of left it open for a sequel.
As you approach the vampire story. That's a fairly well-worked genre, and I'm wondering how you came at it to bring your own fresh approach to it.
Well, the thing that I hadn't seen, or there were certain cliches in the genre that I wanted to address and I didn't want to play into, and one is there always seems to be, you know, somebody in the Mike Myers movie, they call Captain Exposition. You know, there always seems to be like the Van Helsing character who says, and vampires can do this, and this is what kills them, and they can't cross running water, and it sort of lays the rules out for the audience. And I basically wanted someone to get turned into a vampire who didn't get the instruction book and who has to sort of deal with all the insecurities that she had in her day-to-day life as sort of a mid-20s assistant at an insurance company to dealing with, you know, so she carries all of the insecurities of her personal relationship into her life as a vampire. And I hadn't seen that before. Everybody, as you said, basically had explored the mythical possibilities of blood and history and the genesis of the vampire race. So I felt like I was released from having to even address that, and I just wanted to get real characters and sort of react from a place of how a real person would. You know, they still have to do their laundry. Nobody ever says anything about that. Especially if you're sleeping in dirt. My vampires don't, but you know, you have to sleep in your own soil, yet you're always clean and in a tuxedo. How do you work that out? Someone's got to do laundry. And so I basically thought, I've got to address that.
You have a lot of fun with the realism of being a vampire as a source of humor. There's one of vampires no longer have any need for bodily functions and
right.
A lot of that stuff. So tell me a little bit about, did you map all this stuff out before you went, or did you just plunge in headlong and discover it?
I sort of made certain assumptions and then wrote the story as I came across those. And in the first book, you have Jody, who is this 26-year-old secretary who gets turned on her way home from work one night, and she takes on a minion who is Tommy, this 19-year-old guy who works nights at the Marina Safeway. And they have arguments that sort of are the domestic issues that any couple faces, except theirs are, why should I buy toilet paper? I don't go anymore, and things like that. And she sort of pulls rank on him in that there's certain functions she doesn't even, you know, participate in anymore, and therefore she shouldn't have to run the errands that take care of those. Like, for instance, going to the grocery store and getting food, because he is the food. So it was just playing it scene to scene, saying, okay, this is what you do when you're a couple and you're getting together and you're dealing with, you know, the problem that one of you isn't alive. And so it just sort of came in the sequence of how you would come across these things in life, and it played up for comedy, I guess.
One of the things you do very well is to play with our perception of people who dress like vampires and look like vampires, but obviously aren't. And tell us a little bit about, did you explore that subculture at all?
I observed it. I was a little bit too old and a little bit too creeped out to really try to immerse myself in it. But I had been sort of on the edge of the teen angst, alienated culture for a lot of years because I was underemployed for a lot of years and wrote in cafes and hung out in cafes. And there's sort of an axiom that if you sit still long enough, you'll disappear and people will start to behave as if they would if you weren't around. So I would sit outside of this cafe in Central California and watch these very fierce-looking punk and goth kids who frightened locals, actually. You'd watch sort of the suburban crowd walk in great arcs around them on the sidewalk to avoid contact with them. But as soon as the citizens had passed, you know, they'd resume their MacGyver game that they were playing out on the sidewalk, this big game of pretend and what can you make out of a big pen and a book of matches to save you all. And I realized that they were just spooky kids playing dress up. As you know, sort of the blogosphere developed, I started looking at the blogs of goth kids, and they were so funny because there was this great chasm between despair and total goofy kidness that they would transcend in a matter of one sentence. It's like, oh, I must contemplate the darkness that is my being, and then the next thing, but Mom got me a green Care Bear for Christmas. And it was so funny. I would find myself giggling, and I thought, okay, I've got to address this fact that these kids sort of romanticize this whole thing. And again, it goes back to the practicality of being a vampire as opposed to the romantic idea of being a vampire. And in this book, I actually sort of bring the two face to face.
Your first book was written in 1995. Mm-hmm. The follow-up came out in 2007. That's a 12-year gap, but you write them seamlessly as if one follows the other, and it really works. Didn't that chasm scare you?
It really did. The thing that scared me the most was the change in the city of San Francisco. Jody and Tommy live in an area called the Soma, south of Market Street, in the first book. And in 1994, when I was researching that book, that area was like artist's lofts and Pakistani restaurants and transmission places. And then the internet happened, and the geographical center of the internet was the Soma in San Francisco. So what had once been a lot of abandoned warehouses were now these extremely expensive office loft spaces, you know, with basketball goals and espresso machines and pinball machines and so forth, and as well as, you know, upscale sort of techno-yuppie condos and so forth. And then the Metreon had been built, which is this giant high-tech Sony entertainment center by Yerba Buena. So the neighborhood had changed in the extreme, and including in that was the rents went up by about 1,000%. And I was really worried about that. What I ended up doing was talking to a book club, a vampire book club, was meeting at a store called Borderlands in the Mission in San Francisco. And it was all people basically in their 20s who were sort of on the edge of goth culture. And they read a vampire book every month and discuss it. And I teleconferenced with them. And I asked them, what should I do, you know, with this 12-year time period? And they just said, oh, ignore it. And so, you know, using my laser-like novelist powers, I went, oh, okay, I'll just ignore it. And it worked fine. I just acted like, you know, that life went on the next day, and there just happened to be the Sony Metreon. Didn't I mention that in the first book? And actually, a couple of scenes take place, or at least referred to there. So it was, at some level, bothersome to me, but it turned out in writing the book that it worked out fine.
One of the things that's really fun about this book, and really all your books, is the real world is so absurd that when you start spinning in the supernatural elements, they seem perfectly believable. And one of the things you talk about in the Bloodsucking Fiends and in the new book is turkey bowling.
Right.
So once you've got turkey bowling going at the Safeway, the vampires, hey, I can buy that. So tell us, did you ever go turkey bowling?
I did. I ran a night crew when I was Tommy's age, when I was 19. I worked on a night crew in a grocery store in Ohio, and we had a very strong retail clerks union. So we had 13 guys to do the work of four. And I was in charge, and we were all under 23 years old. So it was just a complete circus. And turkey bowling was the least of the things that we did. I actually had guys who would bring firearms into work and shoot product off of the shelves with plastic bullets. And it goes on and on and on. It was just the horrors of unsupervised adolescence or post-adolescence in the middle of the night with sort of a grocery store to play in. I worked a lot of it into the book, but there was some stuff that was even in a book that was peopled with, you know, blue prostitutes and vampires. I didn't think they'd believe some of the stuff that we did working on a night crew when I was a kid.
And speaking of blue prostitutes, I have to say that Blue is the only character almost in any of your books I really just didn't like. And I'm wondering, when you created her, I mean, in every other book, even the really, really bad guys, you really like them. You really like all your characters. And I get the feeling you didn't like Blue very much. And so I'm wondering, tell us a little bit about creating this character and why she's just not very nice.
Well, she's sort of, she has her own history, and you sort of get the feel for her history. Actually, she has more backstory than most of the characters in that sort of, her circle in the book, which are the animals, the night crew that Tommy used to work with at the Safeway. And I think I show how she gets to where she is, but I think anybody who works, who has compromised, let's say their self-image to become a prostitute and gone so far as to have themselves dyed blue, they're going to have compromised morals and ethics, I guess. And so what immediately seems like maybe me making judgment on her, I think I sort of show where she starts as the cheddar queen of Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, and how she ends up as a dyed blue hooker in Las Vegas and taking advantage of these crazy horn dogs from San Francisco with a lot of money in their pockets because they've sold the art collection of an old vampire that they killed or almost killed. And I kind of liked Blue. She's very Cruella de Vil in this book. She sort of takes the place of amid all these people that are all these creatures that are sort of monsters. She's really scary because her self-interest is dialed up to 11, and everybody else has this sort of sense of, well, maybe I shouldn't do that, or maybe I should consider other people's agendas. Blue doesn't do that. But at the end, she's sort of redeemed by the fact that she's frustrated so often in the book. And there's a point where she stops to, she's been turned to a vampire because she wants to be. And she stops to get one of the animals. And he happens to be in his living room, which is full of grow lights for his pot. And as soon as he opens the door, she bursts into flames because of all the UV light that hits her. And she just can't get it right. You know, they go to the zoo. You know, they can't think of any place to find a victim. They end up at the zoo, and like half of them get arms torn off because they think, oh, I'm a super being now. And they try to, you know, drink blood from a tiger and so forth. And you know, she really is sort of the Wile E. Coyote of this book. And so I don't know. It's the same way. Yeah, she's the bad guy, but I don't dislike her. I guess I get her. And she was so much fun because of that, because she would just keep, you know, going and putting on the Acme rocket shoes, knowing that it was just going to blast her into a brick wall no matter what.
Okay. Now, we have to talk about my other favorite character, Abby Normal. Tell us who Abby Normal is.
Abby Normal is a 16-year-old goth girl who has been waiting all her life for something really dark and mysterious to happen. And she first appeared actually in my book, A Dirty Job. She was the best friend of the goth girl clerk in A Dirty Job. Lily was a major character in that book, who worked for a guy who got the job of being Death. I'm sort of going off point, but it tells you who Abby is. And she's sort of, she may or may not have an eating disorder. She doesn't think so. She just likes to hurl. And she's described as the broken puppet kid or the broken clown kid through the book, pretty much. You know, so she's sort of this gamine, knock-kneed, very savvy, very smart city kid who bumbles into the book more or less and ends up being the minion for Jody and Tommy, because now that Tommy is a vampire in this book, they need someone to function during the day for them, and they run into Abby, who couldn't think of a better job than working for an ancient vampire count, which is what Tommy convinces her that he is, because he's actually 19, you know, and, you know, 400 is the appropriate age for a vampire, 19, not so much, but she has a lot more backstory and back knowledge on vampires than he does, even though he happens to be one. So she was just a lot of fun to write. I researched her by reading blogs on vampirefreaks.com, which has the distinction of actually having three serial killers as members of that website.
Accused serial killers?
Arrested, yeah.
Arrested? Wow.
Yeah, sweet. But it's a very, again, it has this, you know, the thing about Abby that makes her so much fun is she's always battling her perky streak. And her friend Lily, you know, basically tells her, you're just terminally, incurably perky. And, you know, this is the bane of her life, to the point where Lily at one point throws Abby's Nintendog virtual beagle puppy under the number 90 overnight bus tire just because she has to give up her perky streak. And that was what was fun about reading, you know, the blogs of these kids is, again, they go from this very sort of nihilistic despair to this sort of perky gummy bear goofiness in a matter of one second. And that's what Abby does. And she took the book over, basically. You know, a lot of the book is told in her journal entries. And strange as it may seem, it's not natural for a middle-aged white guy from the Midwest like me to to speak in the voice of a 16-year-old goth girl. So that was a lot of work to get her the idiom for Abby down. But as it turned out, it really was fun in the end.
It doesn't seem like it was a lot of work. It seemed like it must have flowed so naturally once you got the vibe on that you could. It seemed like you could just write that every day.
I wish that were the case. It was enormously hard work. And every
oh,
day
really?
Before I yeah every day before I sat down to write, I would be reading these blogs on MySpace and on Vampire Freaks for like at least an hour before I'd start, so I could pick up that sort of pattern of speech or pattern of writing that these kids had. And my girlfriend would come into my office and see that I was, you know, lurking like a giant perv on these teenage web pages, and she'd go, oh, the FBI is going to bust through the door any second. And I'm going, I really actually am doing research. I have a book, you know, I'm not interacting. I'm just lurking like a big creepy perv. So, but it was very hard. It was really gratifying when it came off, but it was hard to pick it up.
One of the things that's fun about supernatural and vampire novels is this necessity that writers have to maintain some semblance of normal reality, so that the events you're writing about could have played out in our world. We just didn't read about them in the newspaper. They never get to the newspaper. They never get to the news media. So we never hear about these things. They are reported as some kind of other slightly anomalous phenomena or not at all. And I wonder if you care to talk about the skill and craft of wedging the supernatural into the world in such a way that it can happen and you can have some really wild scenes, but they don't reach our world.
Well, I think that what happens is that everybody, you assume that people in a city, you know, they have this ability to shrug things off, you know, and so even if you see something very extraordinary, you're like, well, nobody's going to believe I saw that, you know, and then 2 hours later, you're thinking, well, it doesn't really matter, does it? And I think that that's what we assume, is there's so many people in such a small area that they will just shrug it off because, you know, it's all well and good that I may have seen, you know, something creepy crawling out of the sewers, but life goes on. You know, the fact is I still have to pay attention to traffic or I'm going to plow into the cab in front of me. And that's how I always look at it, is that people just don't have time to stop and go, oh, by the way, you know, there's weird things happening over there. And a lot of it, you know, the thing with vampires is that they appear human. You know, so a lot of it just looks like really sort of violent, crazy people. And there's certainly no shortage of that in the city. And so, you know, you can write it off to, oh, a violent, crazy people again. Oh, no, someone has killed another person on the street again, you know, and it's so what? You know, that's why they have the police log. So it's not as with vampires in particular, it's not quite as difficult to work it into the fabric of reality, because everybody's really focused on their own life and the woof and warp of their own life rather than, you know, what's going on around them, you know. And if it's not relevant to them, they ignore it.
Tell us a little bit about how you worked out the mythos of the vampire. Yours are somewhat different than our standard issue vampires, and I'm wondering how you developed this to A, make it seem more realistic, and B, make it seem funny.
Well, I didn't really want to attack that, because I thought there were some very good writers who had sort of taken on the whole history and mythos of the vampires. The thing about a vampire book is it doesn't have to really be consistent with the body of vampire literature that's out there. It just has to be internally consistent. And so I think the only thing that I really addressed was actually chosen, you know, the elements of the checklist for vampire powers and weaknesses I chose in my books because I thought they would play out for both suspense and humor. And one was that at sort of GMT sunrise and sunset, or not GMT, but at exact sunrise and exact sunset, when the sun breaks the horizon, My vampires either wake up or go out, and there's no like grogginess in between. If they're in a dead run when the sun breaks the horizon, they fall and they're completely unconscious for, you know, until the sun drops below the horizon. And that just made for a lot of, I mean, they knew, you know, they had almanacs, and they have, you know, in this book they have watches that are set for the sunrise, and you know, an alarm goes off 10 minutes before sunrise so they can find cover in case they happen to not be paying attention. And so it also allowed for a lot of the action to happen when they're not available, when they're not on camera, as you'd say in the movie. But that was largely played for comedy and for suspense, because even, you know, even though I write comedies, you know, the engine to drive any fiction is suspense, and specifically something that has a horror element like this. So you always had to sort of worry, were they going to make it to cover by daylight? And then at some point it becomes Abby's problem to get them in undercover because they are unconscious. And, you know, what if someone's blocking the way to where they need to be at sunup? So that was really the only thing that I think I did anything different on. Everything else had either been done or I didn't feel was relevant. There'd been a lot of blood chemistry work in when I wrote the first book. Leading up to that, a lot of vampire books had, you know, because AIDS was so in the forefront of consciousness, and it's a bloodborne disease, a lot of vampire books had tried to link that. And I didn't want to go down that road. I thought there were people that were better qualified to do it, and I basically wanted to play my mythos for what would work in comedy. And that's how I chose what I did.
Why did you choose to do the specifically the romance aspect? I mean, there's a lot of things you could do with the vampire, but why vampires in love? And actually, that's the other thing, is that Jody and Tommy, you know, they don't seem really well suited for one another.
Well, first, that you know, it is a comedy. Second, you know, that's, I think, all of our weakness, and you know, that's our, what would be the word? Yeah, that's the chocolate that kicks in all of our diabetes. you know, it's there's no more fun way to undo a character than through love. And I just thought initially that the, you know, when the idea occurred to me years ago when I was doing it on radio, it was just very simply, you know, there are so many things that one has to get over when pursuing a relationship with another person. And to have this added aspect of they don't happen to be the same species, I thought would just be a lot of fun to explore. And so it gives characters a vested interest in reacting against one another over and over and over again, as opposed to prey and predator, you know, which is usually the relationship that's pursued in a vampire novel. If you have, there's the cliche, it's the ancient vampire looking for his young, you know, the analog of his ancient love, which is, I'm so tired of that. There's been a couple of attempts to adapt Bloodsucking Fiends to the screen, and they always go in that direction. And I think, have you guys never seen a movie before? Do you not have a problem that everybody tries this and it always is maudlin and stupid? It just seemed, it's another element of conflict, and it gives characters another agenda, you know, and forces them to interact. It's that they love each other, even though they, as you point out, have almost nothing in common.
One thing I really like about this book is this, again, the setting of supernatural San Francisco. I'd like you to talk about this this kind of concept. We've seen it, Stephen King does it, and I think more novelists are doing it, where they have books that are not necessarily in a series, but where we'll have characters in the same milieu intermixing. And there's a lovely scene in You Suck that's the inverse of the scene in A Dirty Job. It's really, I guess, a great Easter egg for your
right,
readers.
And that's exactly what it is. It's what it is. It's exactly the same scene told from a different point of view. And in A Dirty Job, it's told from Charlie's point of view, who runs, you know, who is death but runs death out of a thrift store, And in this one, it's from Jodie's point of view, who is the vampire and delivers an object to him after she's taken a victim in North Beach. That was exactly that. It was a reward to my readers who have stuck with my books over the years. The approach that I take to it, however, is that when you write these characters that are sort of everybody in the best example is I created a character called the Emperor, who's based on Emperor Norton, who is a historical figure in San Francisco, a homeless guy who declared himself emperor of the city back in the 1860s. And the cool thing about it was the city recognized his title. And again, when I was writing the first book, you know, in the mid 90s, you know, homelessness was sort of at the forefront of the national consciousness. And I had seen a lot of tourists in San Francisco treating the homeless with, you know, less respect than anybody deserves. And not so much the locals, but tourists. And I thought, well, what if you had one of these guys that sort of deserved the dignity of his Nut House Napoleon title? And I used the Emperor. Well, he's a very colorful character, and in the book, everybody knows him. Everybody who comes across him recognizes him. He's a character like any neighborhood has a character that you go, oh, that's the guy. That's the guy with a bird on his head guy, or this happens to be the guy who's declared himself emperor of San Francisco. And so if I set another book in this neighborhood, people are going to know about the same guy. And so he is in all three of the San Francisco books simply because you couldn't be in North Beach, Chinatown, you know, the financial district where he basically spends most of his time, Russian Hill, without seeing a guy that's this out there and without knowing who he is. So that's basically what it is just once you create a world, I guess in my head, it just the people live there and life goes on whether I'm there or not. And that may be, I may get put in therapy for saying that, but it's just how I feel. It's like once I set all these characters in motion, they keep going.
You have some really great cop characters, too. Tell us a little bit about them. And you play them for humor as well. And they also both show up in A Dirty Job as well.
Right. These guys, the cop Rivera has been in like five or six of my books. And he started out in Coyote. Or actually, he was in my first book.
He was in
Practical Demon Keeping.
He was.
Yeah, he worked on the Central Coast then. And then he has a brief appearance in Coyote Blue. And then he has... Then he comes back strong in Bloodsucking Fiends as a homicide investigator, and his partner he's now partners with this guy named what is his first name, Nick Cavuto, who is this big, very gruff sort of, you know, blackjack and no mercy kind of cop, except he happens to be gay, and which I was something that I wanted a really non-cliche gay character, and I think Nick Cavuto is definitely that guy. And so they sort of play parts, pretty big parts, in all three of the San Francisco books. And Rivero has, you know, is of a Hispanic background and is very smart and very sharp. He's a sharp dresser and sort of he just continually finds himself in situations that are career destroying, and he, you know, he doesn't look for it. It's just this weird stuff happens to him, and he's like, why am I? But what's happened is over the years, having dealt with all these weird supernatural things, is his credibility factor is wide open. You know, when everybody else in town is going, I can't understand it. Everybody's dying of blood loss. What could it possibly be? Rivera's like, we know what it is, you know, because he's just like, I wouldn't have thought that the giant owl would have attacked the monster on the hill in the first book either. But he's been through all this horrible stuff. But it makes him a much better. He's very tired, but I imagine he believes when strange things happen, and he doesn't freak out, and he has a great relationship with Charlie in A Dirty Job, whereas he knows something spooky and weird is going on with Charlie, who is deaf, but he's not going to flip out about it. You know, he's got other things going on. And as it turns out, we find out that he's also investigating this book. And that's, in fact, in Dirty Job, which obviously preceded this book, he actually comes to Charlie looking for details of what happened to this old man. And now we've found out in this book that this old man was killed by Jody. And euthanized is probably a better term. But so, you know, the cops are just sort of weary, and I think they're probably cliche in a lot of ways because, I mean, my father was a cop, but he wasn't a city cop. So most of what I know about police I've gotten from movies and TV. And so, you know, I don't know. I don't know how cops behave in a morgue. I just know how do they behave on crossing Jordan, you know. And somebody did the research, I assume, along the line somewhere. But I'm not, I don't feel like I write crime fiction, so my cops can be more about personality and less about procedure.
Now, you wrote Bloodsucking Fiends in 95, mm-hmm. and it was very popular with your readers. And you, I believe that they were asking for a sequel. You set it up for a sequel.
Right.
And you've been fielding requests for a sequel for 12 years now, or 10 years. Mm-hmm. What made you finally accede to those requests?
Well, you know, you say it's been very popular with my readers, but it wasn't initially released with... it had a hideous cover on it in hardcover, and it was released in a very small print run. So it didn't do well in hardcover. The publisher dropped the ball. And, you know, I'm not saying that to sound bitter, although I'm sure I do. They printed a really paltry amount, and it didn't do well. And you can't do a sequel to a book that didn't do well. And so what I had to do was wait until my career recovered enough that I could propose it to my new publisher and say, look, I'm going to do this, and I think enough people will read it just because they've read everything that I write. And so it basically, having taken 10 years to recover from the setback that Bloodsucking Fiends caused, I don't think due to the story, but due to the really sort of malpractice of release by the publisher at the time. So, because I think people who read the book were always enthusiastic about it, and they perceived that everybody would be. What they didn't realize is not that many people got to see it. But over 10 years, the paperback had garnered enough of an audience that this book would do well. And then my books like Lamb and Fluke and A Dirty Job had been bestsellers. And so people recognized my name. And so I basically had recovered enough and had a big enough audience that, you know, I get one free. I could just write anything and people would buy it. And this book has done really well, so I may do a third one. Because now I've set Abby Normal in motion, and I, you know,
well, you can't she, seems like
a,
Normal,
she seems like a force that can't be denied, so I may have to write more about her.
And then there's the guy with the big cat.
Right, Chet the Giant Shaved Cat, which we don't want to give too much away, but, you know, I'm sure that if this is ever made into a movie, it will be... The ASPCA will definitely be all over this because we, Tommy and Jody, have their way with the Chet the giant shaved cat.
When you start to write funny vampire books, or come back to write them, you wrote the first book. Was Buffy the Vampire Slayer already in existence then?
I think the movie had come out
and not done very well.
Yeah, the movie had come out, which I liked.
Uh-huh.
But the show hadn't come out, and Josh Whedon is a brilliant guy, and so before I wrote this one, I got all of the Buffy's on DVD because I hadn't watched it over the years. The series, I just, you know, didn't have time. I didn't like it, and I wanted to make sure that I wasn't using any material that Joss had written, you know, because he does write great dialogue, really funny dialogue. And so I watched, you know, what, 5 years of Angel and 7 years of Buffy on DVD. And, you know, what I couldn't get on DVD, I downloaded and just to make sure. And I actually did have to change some of the stuff I was going to do in this book because it had been used as a plot in Angel. It doesn't matter what it was because I didn't do it. But and that happens, you know, if you're working in the same field, you're bound to have... you're bound to have similar ideas, you know. I would guess that helped. There's also been a subgenre that of kind of a chick lit vampire genre that's sprung up since Bloodsucking Fiends. And I sort of feel like, okay, I wrote the first single girl vampire book and nobody read it, you know, but now it's a huge best-selling subgenre of fiction in general. I mean, it does, I'm trying to think of the people who write in this.
It's paranormal romance. Nancy Holder writes in it.
Is she the one that does Undead and Unwed? And
No, I think you're thinking, is that
Kim Harrison?
Kim Harrison's one, and I'm trying to think.
Charlene Harris.
Charlene Harris, yeah.
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 And they're doing great. You know, they're doing great in that sort of chick lit vampire romance thing, you know, and you know, more power to them. Good.
A lot of your humor involves in the language, and I'd like you to tell me a little bit about the humor that's best read as opposed to, you know, heard, and how you play that, because you avoid puns.
Yeah, I don't like puns at all. I don't read my books, as you know, because you forced me to read under much duress many, many times, and I keep telling you I don't read. I've written essays on why I don't read aloud. While I appreciate the music of language, I don't read my own stuff very well, and I think other people do. Fisher Stevens has read a couple of my books on audio, and he's done a terrific job. I haven't heard the audio of this book yet. Dialogue is very much about meter and very much about timing, especially comic dialogue. And so there's a sound that you have to have in your head. And I think I have a sense of how to put like the attributives, the he says and she says to allow for comic timing, or how to put in a short piece of description to build to a punchline and so forth. I guess that's what you're talking about. I also pick words that I just think sound funny. And I scour the internet for, you know, to the urbandictionary.com and to different sites that come up with neologisms, because there are some great words. And then I go, you know,
like
most of them are fairly obscene. And Abby uses a lot of them, but
well, let's hear them.
One that people have great, great response to, because I use it a lot to refer to the president, is fucktard. You know, some of the things like, you know, the tattoo that women get across their lower back is called a tramp stamp. Or in England, it's called a slag tag. I'm trying to think of some of them. But I mean, there's just it's just a wealth of really funny stuff that, and also many of them that just sound funny. And I will go, you know, back through, you know, Shakespeare's oeuvre to find words that I just think sound great. And you know, it's easy. Nothing's off limits except mean-spiritedness, as far as I'm concerned, in comedy. And so if I can crack somebody up because they come around the corner and come up on a word that just cracks them up, well, then my work is done that day, you know?
One of the things you're a master at is interspersing your narrative with the word fuck.
Yes, I am a master of that. I have my MFA in using the word fuck.
I'm wondering, when you rewrite, do you have to go back and like measure the density of, you know, like do a word search and find out how many times it occurs on the page and pull it out or put more back in?
The only time I've ever thought about that was when I wrote Lamb, and I had a couple of friends read it. My girlfriend read it in manuscript, and of all the sort of sacrilegious, or as I like to say, sacrilicious things that happen in Lamb, the thing that they couldn't get past was Jesus saying the F word. And I went, okay, if it's going to throw people out of the story, and that I hadn't heard that before, other than, you know, from like blue haired ladies and who cares. I went back and took it out, except in two instances, because if it was going to stop you from being able to pursue the story, you know, then I hadn't done my job. But other than that, I don't even think about it. I remember turning this book in and thinking, is there too much about breasts in here? Because there's a lot of breast scenes in here, you know, either from Abby Normal, who basically, you know, is angry because everybody has big breasts except her, or, you know, and then I just But it turns out nobody's, I guess not, because nobody said anything. Nobody says, why do you have so many scenes, you know, that mention Hooters? I think a lot of it is that Tommy is 19 years old, and that's basically what he thinks about, you know.
Center of his universe.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and then...
Centers.
Yeah, and then you deal with, you know, when Blue gets turned into a vampire, you have sort of her body getting rid of all those non-organic accoutrements. enhancements that she's visited upon herself. So there, you know, anyway, my editor said, no, it's fine. Don't worry about it. You know, people love tits. So I think that's what she said. Very Max Perkins in her literariness.
So what's next?
I am doing a comedy set in medieval England with Shakespearean themes.
Wow. That's a change of pace.
I wish people could see your face. You're like, dude. That was the total dude face. It's going to be really hard.
And how are you going to work the Emperor of New York?
Not a problem. You know, not a problem. It's going to be something I haven't ever done before. And usually when I take on a project that is something I've never done before, I do pretty good work, or at least, you know, because it's hard, because I have to work hard, and it's not, there's no, oh, I did this before in this book, or I did this before in that book. I mean, I have to, this, a big challenge for this book has been trying to come up with the idiom in which to tell it, because it basically takes place in medieval times. I'm not going to write it, you know, a la Chaucer, you know, in Middle English, and I certainly can't write it in Elizabethan English, even though it has Shakespearean themes to it. So I've got to come up with this sort of hybrid language that sounds to an American audience like it could be English, you know, British English, but is very clear and communicates, and I get the timing of it. It's the entire reason I'm doing the book is so that I can use the words tosser and wanker a lot, just because I think they crack me up.
Now you mentioned that there have been some attempts to film Blood-Sucking Freaks.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering if anything is out there that is filmable that somebody's aiming a camera at.
Not yet. They've all been bought or optioned for film at one time or another. Every one of them. And there's some great people who are interested in You Suck, and there's a deal happening. But a deal, I don't talk about deals other than to say they're happening, because they've never panned out to a movie. I mean, I get a check and I get to, you know, pay rent and fun stuff like that. But even when extraordinary people have been involved, the things have never gotten to the stage of turning on a camera. So, I mean, I can tell you Chris Columbus has a dirty job.
You really?
Know? Yeah. And that's, I couldn't ask for better talent, you know, than that. And
a good match, too.
Yeah, and he's a San Francisco guy, and he does the dark, yeah, he's the man. And, you know, so I'm hoping things will happen, and, you know, Betty Thomas is acquiring You Suck, and she's a great director. She did Dr. Dolittle, which was hilarious, and it was filmed in San Francisco, so she's got a handle in the city and comic timing, and I don't know, she's got like 20 movies, the Brady Bunch movie, and you know, a bunch of, but they're all comedies, and she gets comedy, and so I'm excited about that. But other than my admiration for people who also like my work, it means nothing. It means nothing until they turn on the camera, and it doesn't mean that these people aren't good or earnest in their efforts. It's just that it's such a huge rock to turn, and people continually. They come to my stuff saying, and I'm not the names I mentioned. This is usually the Suits, saying it's not like anything we've ever seen before. And then when they get down the road in the development stage, the thing that always stonewalls them is how can we make this like everything we've ever seen before? You know, I just got fired off of a TV series that I was hired to create for that very reason. They came to me saying, oh, well, you know, we've never seen an imagination like this. If we could just take this, nobody's ever seen anything like what you could do for TV. And I did what they asked, and when I turned it in, they said, if you could just make it a little more like Lost, and, you know, take the supernatural element out of it, and everything.
Oh my God.
That, yeah, all the stuff that I do well, they didn't want. You know,
tell us a little bit about this series. It sounds great. What would it have been had you been, had somebody sane been in charge?
Well, the initial series I submitted to them as it's in outline was. And actually, they own this, so I probably am in breach of contract by even telling you. But it was basically sort of Northern Exposure set in Hawaii, and it was set around this guy who was pretending to be a site archaeologist, which they have to have in Hawaii, you know, to keep from desecrating. Actually, they don't keep from desecrating grave sites of Hawaiians. They just have a guy that goes, yep, that's what that is. Bring in the backhoe, you know. And that'll look great. You know, it is. It's wildly sacred, and it'll look great as a Walmart. It was about a guy who was doing that, and he was running across, you know, sort of a lot of the Hawaiian myths were actually manifesting themselves in reality. And then there was just this goofy cast of characters that live in places like remote islands. And a typical episode would have been, you know, would they have all these cane toads that they brought over there to eat the bugs?
They
the
brought
beetles.
Cane toads over?
Yeah.
How insane were they?
Well, they wanted to, you know, it was a natural, supposedly insect control thing, except the insects are diurnal and the toads are nocturnal, so they never saw each other. But we have a buttload of toads, and they get run over. So there's a lot of flat, crispy, dried toads all over. These also happen to be the same toads that you can lick for hallucinogen effect. So one of the episodes would be these two enterprising surfer guys decide to start a mail order business, you know, flattriptoads.com, where they send off hallucinogenic toads in, you know, a 9x12 envelope to different areas of the country, you know. And I just thought, yeah, okay, that I'd watch that. That's like must-see TV as far as I'm concerned. And they didn't think so. So then they hired me to write one of my books into a series. And
which book?
Island of the Sequin Love None.
Oh, okay.
And
Pine wanted, Cove again.
No. Actually, it's the one that takes place in Micronesia.
Oh, right.
Yeah, about the cargo call.
Yeah,
And it's it was
not enough like Lost.
Yeah, actually, my Hawaiian series I called Found. I'm not even sure what was wrong with Island of the Sequin Love None, except that they kept wanting me to work on it and kept wanting me to work on it, and they didn't want to pay me to do any more work on it. And I was like, you know what, you guys, I don't have time for this if you're not going to pay me more. And they were like, oh. Anyway, I need to let people who do that sort of thing do that sort of thing. And I need to go write books, which is what I do.
And you do it very well.
Oh, well, thank you. I do. Long years of studying. Yeah.
One thing I wanted to ask you, just to wrap this up. You know, when we first talked, which was a few years ago, we talked about mid-list authors.
Uh-huh.
And that was still somewhat in existence then. And to a certain extent, that's, I think, where your publisher had placed you. And now that's absolutely not the case with you.
No.
So tell us a little bit about how that feels as a writer to achieve this kind of, you know, rock star success.
It's huge in some ways, in that your credibility is off the scale compared to, you know, I'm a guy who wrote a book, especially now that there's so much vanity press. It's very easy to do, you know, print on demand vanity press. So, you know, anybody who has a computer and $500 can publish a book. You know, you never know. There's no credibility anymore in saying, yeah, I have, you know, two books in print. You know, it doesn't, even though, you know, it was the guy down at Kinko's that printed them. In the publishing world, you know, I've been doing this for, you know, going on 20 years. Most of it as a mid-list author. And I've been treated, you know, both sort of shoddily by publishers and really great by publishers as a mid-list author. I got to say, I've been with my current publisher for, going on 10 years now. And they're terrific. And they've always been terrific. I mean, they're the reason I'm now a best-selling author, as well as, you know, people finding their way to my books. But The difference is you get to fly first class, on your long flights. I'm still at the point where not on all my flights, but on my long flights, I get first class. And you get to go basically where you want to go as far as, if BEA is in New York and you want to go. BEA is the big national book convention for booksellers. And it's a huge thing to be able to be in the same room with all the booksellers and all the people from the publishing company. And I didn't even get to go until like 4 years ago. But now if I want to go, I get to go because they got to send me because I'm, a little diva now. So it's just, you just get a little more deference in the publishing world, which is a very small town. As soon as you walk out of that big building in New York, nobody knows who you are, and the cab drivers are still rude to you, and you still don't order fast enough at the deli, and there is a little bit more recognition in the world. I've been recognized a couple of times. And in 20 years, a couple of times is not a lot. It's not a big invasion on my privacy. Usually it's when I don't want to be recognized. I was in Hawaii going to the post office one day, and this little Jack Russell Terrier ran out in front of my car, and I ran over him. And and it didn't kill him. I was driving an SUV, which you had to where I lived in Hawaii. And he sort of rolled under the car and got up really mad and started running at me like, I can't believe he ran over me, And I felt horrible. Then he ran. And he was like, wait a minute, I just got run over. And he went, ran off into the jungle. And I was chasing him, and his owner was after him. And I was just completely chagrined because I just run over a little dog, and he was pissed. And as I'm running across this field, it was. Adjacent this outdoor cafe, and this girl at this table goes, is everything okay? And I go, I just ran over the dog. She goes, oh yeah, I saw the whole thing. It wasn't your fault. And she goes, aren't you Christopher Moore, the author? Like, yeah, that's exactly when I want to be recognized. That was the first time I was ever recognized out in the street, was after I'd run over the little dog. It's like, oh yeah, he's the guy who runs over the cute little dogs, and they hate him for it. So there's a little bit of that, but for the most part, it's just, more deference within the publishing world. You sort of get what you ask for, and you have to be careful at that point what you ask for, because you'll get it. For years you go, I want a full page ad in the New York Times, and they're like, yeah, that's going to happen. And then all of a sudden you get it, and you're like, oh, well, what if this doesn't work? I've done some, now that they'll listen to me, I've done some really stupid things. I did the stupidest angel version 2.0.
Which, I love that.
I know, but it did nothing but confuse most people.
Really?
Yeah. I got all these kind of panicked letters. What's the difference between version 1 and version 2.0? And I said, well, we just did that to be cute. There's just a bonus chapter in it. But I couldn't believe how chagrined people were and confused by it, because all of a sudden they thought, oh, do I need to download an update or something like that? So, and that was totally my idea, and it was stupid.
No, it was great.
Oh, okay. That's what I meant. And it was great.
Maybe not for the guy sitting writing the checks, though.
Yeah, well, and the book did well. It didn't hurt the sales of the book. It was just sort of, it confused people, and that's not what you're going for as a writer. But anyway, so that's a rather long answer of what it's like to be a best-selling author. You get to say, I'm a best-selling author,
And what about the quill?
Oh, I won two of those. I won
two?
I won best horror novel for Stupidest Angel, and then this year I won best novel. It was really funny. The coverage was the year I won for best horror novel. I didn't get mentioned in the coverage because, it's horror. Mm-hmm. And this year when I won for best novel, they didn't mention best novel in any of the coverage because, it's him. It was really funny. it literally was not even mentioned, And the best thing about the quill is it's reader choice. And so it's not that I have the most readers, obviously, it's that I have the most enthusiastic readers. I have readers that I communicate with on a day-to-day basis, but also, they feel sort of a loyalty enough to, make the effort to vote. And that was terrific. It's a terrific, that's the best part of the award. I mean, the award itself is kind of, it sucks ass. It's it's this piece of lucite that fell apart with a piece of, anyway. And I'd like to thank the Academy for giving it to me. But no, the best thing about it is it's just an affirmation to the readers that say, not only do I like this guy enough to, find a website, sign on, and vote, you know, for him. And so that's been greatly gratified. And now that I have two, I can actually use them as bookends, which is cool.
We've been speaking with Christopher Moore. His new book is You Suck, He Doesn't. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.